Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. Once again, we could not do it without you. You did an excellent job tonight. And please, would you get Mike, our technical expert, would you please get him a sedative, since he just discovered the name and star of a radio show on Blog Talk Radio. I'll comment on about that later. Unbelievable, Mike. I can't believe it either, but we'll reserve that for future commentary. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen, and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us on that marvelous trip to 90 cities and states across the United States. And yes, he does sing that song from memory. He's probably singing it tonight up there in the clouds somewhere. Emily and Mike, when he recovers, we want to thank you for joining us tonight and for all the work that you do for our radio show. What we do on the show, ladies and gentlemen, is discuss news and issues and events and developments and the always difficult, sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Actually, sometimes it's more humorous than it is practical. But anyway, we'll have some stories tonight that are something on that order, I think, in the way of humor. Tonight we're going to be dealing with a show. We do dedicate the show to tireless police, courts, corrections, juvenile justice professionals who protect us in the United States, throughout the world, and who knows where else. We try to look inside criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at the professional. Tonight we're going to take a look at that series that I've mentioned, I think, the last 2 weeks, Top Secret America, done by Dana Priest, and William Arkin. These are two journalists for the Washington Post. Priest is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. They took 2 years to study the counterterrorism and intelligence networks and services and organizations that the United States government finances and directs here in the United States. And of all the things I've seen, I've been in criminal justice since dirt was discovered, and I'm telling you, I've never read a series like this in a newspaper article in my life. And some of the events, which I'll start off tonight to help get you started, we're going to hear the people themselves talk, both Arkin and Priest, and then we're going to hear people calling in to a radio show, an NPR show, and talking about this. And some of the people calling in are actually going to be people that work in the intelligence business. So it is just absolutely incredible to realize that 1,200 organizations. They didn't develop overnight. It only took 6 years. But 1,200 different organizations, some enormous, 1,200, are working in the counterterrorism and intelligence service in 10,000 locations across the United States, and physical plant facilities that, too, will now soon be larger than the Pentagon. And 1,900 private contract agencies, such as your friends Google and others, contracting and doing the same type. General Dynamics is a big one. If you don't even know anything about criminal justice and you're listening, this will just knock your socks off. It's unbelievable. And the billions of dollars this is costing us, and I know I'm overdoing this, but we're going to be pointing to the fact that the Christmas Day bomber, remember the underwear bomber in Detroit? We had advanced information about him. These agencies had that information. They didn't know who to send it to and how to coordinate the intelligence. And, of course, you've got a whole group devoted to radical Islamic business in the United States, one of these organizations, and they never put their finger on and passed the information on concerning the army doctor, quote unquote, who shot the people and killed people at Fort Hood. So I think this, if you have not gone to, they now have a website for it, just that, you don't have to go to the Washington Post, go to topsecretamerica.com, topsecretamerica.com, and you can get the a whole series, all the graphics, all the data sets that will just absolutely blow your mind. I'll stop right there. This is Blog Talk Radio. It's a leading edge technology, and I guess I can say it, we've even seen the self-proclaimed crime profiler, Pat Brown, using this technology. I did not know that she had a show. President Obama uses it, too. But if you look at Pat Brown's credentials as a crime profiler, you'll see that she went to college, got a master's degree, taught a course, this is her writing, taught a course in a community college, an associate degree program, and gave a certificate for students who took it. And then her publications, you can't find them. Oh, well. I'll stop. Crime profiling is one of my favorite subjects to talk or not talk about in the field of criminal justice. Much of it is in the category of hoax. Alan Levy is the CEO of BTR, and he's the genius behind this medium. And he started with one show 4 years ago. We joined in probably a month or two after the whole thing got started, maybe 3 months, something like that. And we're now up to the point where there are thousands and thousands and thousands of shows on almost any subject imaginable, from laughter yoga to astronomy, cigar, wine tasting. You mentioned it, and there's a show probably on that subject. So any person, any interest group, any organization can have their own show broadcasting live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and it's absolutely free. This is astronomical. This is the best gift that anyone could ever have. If you want to do radio broadcasting, you can start in 15 minutes on blogtalkradio.com. All right. Tonight's show, as I mentioned, we're going to deal with the issue of a top secret America, and you cannot believe how top secret it is, and I'll reserve all my comments till later when we introduce this particular topic. Well, we do have a blonde joke tonight. Audrey has one tonight, and Audrey was a little afraid. She checked this one out with me, that this one might be a little pink or on the risque side. And Audrey, I don't think so. I mean, it's got to do sort of with clothing. I mean, it's not a big deal. So let's go ahead. Our show is built for general audiences, by the way, so children can listen, and I think we're absolutely safe on this one, particularly in this age. All right. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, our blonde joke for tonight has to do with a blonde girl attending school. I think our listeners will enjoy it and not be taken back by it. Here it is. Day one. A blonde comes home from school and says to her mother, "We learned how to count up to 5 today. I got up to 10. Is it because I'm blonde, Mommy?" Mom replies, "Yes, dear." Day two, we learned how to do the alphabet today, Mommy. The others only got up to the letter G, and I got up to S. Is it because I'm blonde? Mom replies, "Yes, dear." Day three. We learned about breasts today, Mommy. All the other girls are flat-chested, and I'm a 36DD. Is it because I'm blonde, Mommy? Mom replies, no, dear. It's because you're 25 years old.
Oh, thank you, Audrey. I like that one very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has a public service announcement. I can never remember their name. The Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has a public service announcement that we've been playing for a long time, and we know the message in this announcement is for the criminals to hear this and to lay down their arms, to get down and turn them in to the local police department. So go ahead, Ohio Coalition, let's hear your fine public service announcement one more time.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and it certainly is a deadly idea. And ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of saving the planet, and I heard Al Gore make a very serious public statement here this past week, in fact, just in the last couple of days, about how we're losing our interest in sustaining the planet and reducing global warming. And he was saying, that we should, in fact, do public demonstrations. In other words, it's time to hit the streets on global warming. So in the interest of saving the planet, we've always done some type of green tip, and we've relied heavily on Esma Floyd's little book, Esma Floyd, ESME, a book called 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And one of our ways tonight is this one, and I must admit I'm guilty. I don't pay attention to this, but here's what it says. She's suggesting that to sustain the planet, don't let the faucet run. Don't leave the faucet running while you wash up and rinse. Instead, save precious water by putting in the plug and filling up the sink so you wash as many items as possible using the same water. The same goes for rinsing. So use that water over and over. And I think one of the things that she's also suggested that on bath water, that you could, didn't she say, Mike, that you could keep it like a couple days? You know, bathe one day, keep it in there, come back the next. You first, not me. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. And she also said that when you're getting your dishes ready, your washing dishes, do not rinse them off before you put them in your washer. Your dishwasher is made to deal with dirty dishes. So just let all the stuff crust up on them and, dry up and all that business and just put them right straight in your dishwasher, and your dishwasher will clean them. And in the long run, you'll be saving resource and helping save the planet in the long run. But those are two really good tips, and I'm going to try to live by those myself if I can. All right, let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news, and some of it is actually off the page. We've been using Evernote to collect our news here lately. I don't know if folks are familiar with Evernote, E-V-E-R-N-O-T-E, Evernote.com. Wonderful clipping service. Google Notebook, it's still available to me because I was a long-time user, but they dumped it for everybody, just about everybody else. I switched over to Evernote, and it allows you to clip the page and store it, and you can see it in several different view formats. Very useful service, and it's free. You can buy the extra service, but unless you're clipping a million notes a month, it's probably not going to happen. So let's go ahead and take a look at some of these news stories on Evernote. And the first one here really has to do with planet sustainability also, and it relates in the long run, I think, to criminal justice. And in some ways, well, it doesn't relate to criminal justice, but if I can get it up on the page, we have so many browsers open tonight. Mike, is it going to come up? Yes, it did. It did come up. okay, let's see if we can find this one here first, because I really like this story. Okay, I won't be able to find it. We're looking. Is that it? No, that's not it. Okay, here's something. Hold on. I know you're
patient. Huh. What did it know? I was just bragging about Evernote. Huh. We'll find it. It'll come up here somewhere. So let's start with the next story. This one is a much more serious one. This one has to do with, oh, where in the world did that go, Mike? It's got to be in there somewhere. Huh. Well, I'll be. That's something. Okay, let's deal with this one. This has to do with killing of homeless. I've always had a soft spot in my heart for the homeless, about a third of those people out on the street living there. Of course, some choose to, but not a lot. They're out on the street, and what's happened is the deaths of the homeless have actually gone up. Here the last couple of years, as the rise in killing of homeless people has risen to the highest level in a decade, with 43 people killed last year, and many more of them injured in often brutal attacks that are raising concerns among law enforcement officials, rights advocates, and politicians, according to this new data. The rise in killings from 27 in 2008 up to 43 comes as many state and local governments are wrestling with the problem of what to do with the growing number of people that are forced onto the street because of economic woes. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, that could never be me. I've met some on the streets who tell you that it could be you. You're maybe a couple of steps away from being out on the street many times. But anyway, the National Coalition for the Homeless, which is a wonderful organization, they are talking about stories where homeless people are doused with gasoline, they're set on fire, they're attacked with bottles and metal pipes and baseball bats, and they're sprayed with pepper spray, often for the sport of it. Isn't that incredible? There's a thing now that you can get pictures on, get your picture up on YouTube. They're asking if the FBI start tracking these crimes. They don't do it. This data actually comes from the National Coalition on the Homeless. But what happens is these street thugs get out there on the street, and this is kind of a sport for them. They'll smash their skull with metal pipes and that type of business, and they'll go to fast food restaurants and beat up a bum. That type of thing, and then they'll post this business up on entertainment or on one of the websites. In fact, what's it actually called, the corny little thing they engage in? But anyway, can't find that in the article somewhere. But anyway, they're doing this, and this is kind of a fun thing for them to do. This has been around, you know, about a decade that I can recall. But I think the people that are caught for doing something like that ought to have the book literally thrown at them to go out and do things like that to homeless people. Many of these are elderly people in their 60s, sometimes in their 70s. They're caught out on the street, and they don't know what to do. But isn't that incredible? What kind of person would actually do that to somebody? Well, one of the big news items this week, of course, was what? The case of Blago. Blagojevich, the governor, who was found not guilty on 23 of 24 charges against him. And people are just kind of shocked by this verdict. And they were close. After 3 weeks of respectful but increasingly tense deliberation, 11 jurors were ready to convict Rod Blagojevich of what prosecutors called a political corruption crime spree. You need to know more about that. It sounds worse than it is, because on most of the charges, they were about 50-50. 50% were for conviction and 50% were. On one of the other corruption charges, only one juror hung out. But when you read this article about this, it's an Associated Press article, and that's recent, I think it was yesterday. It says that you know, they threw all these charges at him. You know how sometimes the federal government works. You've heard me talk about Harvey Silverglade's book, Three Felonies a Day. And they threw all these charges at him. And what was the one that they convicted him on? One of the two that sent Martha Stewart to prison for X number of months. And that was, in fact, making a false statement to a federal agent. Remember what Harvey Silverglade said about that? These laws are written so general, and on making a false statement to a federal agent, you don't even need a criminal mind, in other words, a criminal intent. You can think you're passing on the right information, and if it turns out wrong, you can go to prison for up to 5 years. And remember, Martha Stewart was not convicted of insider stock trading and all those other charges. She was convicted of obstruction of justice and making a false statement to a federal agent. Those are the two big hang them all type of charges. But all this time and all this money and all these prosecutors and assistant prosecutors, the cost of the defense, the time and all that business, they come up with one conviction. And they're going to try him again. They're going to do it again and cost us, these are federal prosecutors. You know, something about federal prosecutors that most people don't realize, you know, they don't get the daily attention in the newspaper or at least weekly attention that a local prosecutor does. I mean, people don't pay any attention to them. They're not a household word like they might. A prosecutor might be in some big city. So when they go after these things, these cases, they usually go after them in a big way. In other words, they try to get a knockout punch so that they can establish some type of reputation. And I think that's the case for this prosecutor. I'll comment probably more about him next week. He's one that you will recognize, U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald. That's what you call a prosecutor at the federal level, as the United States Attorney. And he thanked the jury for their service, but refused to comment on their decision, citing the need to prepare for Blagojevich's second trial. Now, if you listen to Blagojevich, you go on the Internet, listen to him talk about it. He's on the phone talking to people. They play these audio recordings in court. You know, he goes on. He's got a foul mouth. Every other word is this and that. But he's fantasizing. You know, I ought to do this and make him give me so many dollars. I ought to do whatever. I mean, he's just running his mouth. And here he gets stuck with most of these things. Plus, he's an Illinois governor. You know, the last two are going to prison. Governor Ryan, most appropriately, went when he was convicted for corruption in office. It took him 7 years to get him. Can you believe it? 7 years. He finally was sentenced to an honor camp in southern Wisconsin so he could be close to home. How sweet. I'm sure you and I would get the same treatment. But anyway, it's just an incredible case that most people can't even believe. Here's a little story about America's most stressed city. Have you read that? The most stressful city to live in the United States, apparently, is Las Vegas. I thought people went, their stress management center of Nevada is swamped with residents flooding in to tell their stories and get help. And they often complain, it says here, about irregular work hours that keep them away from their families and tensions that result from these health crises. Las Vegas has got its share of stressors. I thought you went there to get rid of your stressors. And this is a comment by Kathleen Grace Santor, Master of Education, ED.F. I don't know exactly what that degree is. What is that? Mike? I don't know either. A therapist and a yoga instructor who founded the center, and she studied stress for 15 years. Got to remember now, Haley hired the first guy in the United States to ever write a book about police stress. And that was Bill Crowes back in the 1970s, University of Cincinnati. His book was called Policeman Society's Victims. And then we went off the page on stress. Everything became a stressor. You know, carrying money in your pocket, if it was too heavy, you know, what men in their pants pocket, was, you know, the change was too heavy, that was a stressor. I mean, on and on and on. But anyway, frayed nerves in Sin City is what they're talking about. They have 36 million tourists per year there. And are the tourists stressed? I guess just the residents are. But they list other cities here. Houston's one of them, too. And Houston's economy is healthy. Its unemployment is relatively low, so it's all the working they're doing. You know, they're working an average, the longest hours of any city. They're working an average of 41.2 hours a week. What's the matter, Audrey? I know, you work more than that. 41.2 hours a week they're working in Houston. How terrible. I always said, when you list all these cities, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Houston, Tampa, Florida, Riverside, California, all on and on and on, all these cities, has anyone ever heard of the word move? M-O-V-E. It's an action step where you decide I don't like it here, so I move to someplace that is less stressful. And, you know, unemployment, you can handle that the same way. I don't think I've ever had a job where I didn't have to move to go get the thing. I think the Oklahomans picked up and went west during the Dust Bowl, you know, zillions of them at a time. So some of these people who go into stress centers, maybe I'll think about moving as opposed to a laughter yoga or something like that. They're going to sue Sheriff Joe. It's a long article. I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go into it. But Sheriff Joe is going to probably get sued by the federal government. Eric Holder, our United States Attorney General, has threatened him that he better cooperate in this investigation of profiling his particular agency. And Sheriff Joe and others are saying he's cooperating 100%. But there's still, you know, the politics of the new immigration law and the fact that Sheriff Arpaio enforces the law and checks and sees if people are illegal. All right, let me, on the illegal immigration notice, let me flip over to this one, which I think will just make you turn over in your on your couch if you're listening tonight. Listen to this. Mexico is going to offer online degree programs to citizens who live abroad. And what's the reason? The Mexican government will begin offering online college degree programs this month to its citizens living abroad, many of whom are suffering the effects of stricter immigration controls in the United States. Oh, that evil United States wanting you to obey the law relative to immigration and entering our country. Isn't that something? The Public Education Secretariat opened its own virtual university in August of 2009. Since then, 33,000 students have enrolled in 15 undergraduate majors at the Natural Open and Distance University of Mexico. The National Open and Distance University. Now, what would you major in if you went to a school like that? One of the majors, one of the majors that they have is called tourism. You can major in tourism. I wonder if that's illegal tourism. That would be an appropriate major. But they have four or five other majors. But the first one they mention is, in fact, tourism. They're saying there are 12 million undocumented workers that live in the United States. I want to correct them and say it's more like 18 million, maybe 19 million by now. And they need to be able to go to college. And Mexico is going to provide that service for them. I wonder if they could provide it back home. Well, yeah, they wouldn't want to do that because then they'd lose their $20 billion a year they get from illegal Senate money, money back home. But isn't that absolutely incredible. Mexico is going to offer online degree programs. Well, ladies and gentlemen, now we're going to shift to the top secret American business. We're going to listen to an audio of an NPR show that lasts about 27 minutes. And it's called talked about the intelligence failures in the United States, and it has to do with top secret America. And they're having on the show Dana Priest and William Arkin. These are both the authors of the three-part series called Top Secret America. These are investigative journalists, and they have, in fact, worked on this story for 2 years. And it is absolutely incredible. I'm going to give you just a little bit of just a page one of 31 pages of what they found out. And I think last week I might have even mentioned this. 1,271 government organizations and 1,931 private companies work on programs related to counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence in about 10,000 locations across the United States. I won't read that again, but I should. Can you believe this? We're talking about 3,100 different organizations and companies working on intelligence and counterterrorism on homeland security across the United States. 854,000 people, nearly 1.5 times as many people that live in Washington, D.C., now hold top secret security clearances. In Washington and the surrounding area, 33 building complexes for top secret intelligence work are under construction or have been built since September 2001. They occupy the equivalent of almost three Pentagons. In fact, there's a building being built right now, St. Elizabeth's Hospital grounds in Washington, D.C., the famous hospital. They are, in fact, getting a new building that's going to be larger than the Pentagon. I could go on, but I won't. We're just going to go ahead and play this. Give me time to make the transition to the audio, and I think you're just going to be spellbound by what these folks are going to say. We were close.
Say hello to the new NPR Music app for the iPhone, a music magazine for your ears. Read, hear, and experience on the go. But now, or visit us later at nprmusic.org. Love at first listen. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In response to 9/11, no effort and no expense was spared to build up the capability to counter the threat of international terrorism. We're told that many plots have been broken up. Attacks prevented by good intelligence work, but U.S. intelligence failed to connect the dots that could have prevented the attempt to blow up an airliner over Detroit, the fizzled car bomb in Times Square, and the shootings at Fort Hood. Today, the Washington Post published the first of three articles that describe the enormous growth of national security organizations over the past 9 years, an apparatus so vast it overwhelms itself with information with one answer for every problem, war. Later in the hour, Sophia Nelson joins us on the opinion page to argue that Black America needs a Tea Party movement of its own. But first, top secret America. If you've worked in the intelligence community since 9/11, call, give us your estimate of growth, capability, and efficiency. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. It's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. William Arkin and Dana Priest. William Arkin is a national security reporter for the Washington Post. Dana Priest, an investigative reporter. They conducted a 2-year investigation. The report is called Top Secret America. The series began today. And Bill Arkin is with us from the studio of the Post. We expect Dana Priest shortly. Bill, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
And let's go back to that airliner over Detroit on Christmas Day. An example you write in your article that shows both the good side that when U.S. intelligence picked up disturbing news from Yemen and responded to it quickly.
Well, I think the case of the underwear bomber in December is a perfect example of how both the system works and doesn't work. We see an example here of the vast apparatus of the U.S. intelligence community collecting bits of information in Yemen and elsewhere. They had many hints that this was going on. But in the end, it just wasn't able to communicate that, to analyze it in such a way, to put it together so that the Homeland Security apparatus or the law enforcement apparatus was able to actually interdict the person before he got on the plane. And it wasn't until a watchful passenger noticed that the attack was thwarted. And I think that it not only shows them, therefore, how we really are a decade later in a situation where we haven't solved the problem of sharing information, of connecting the dots, of having all of the various disparate parts of the government work together, but also at the same time, all of the evidence leads us to believe that not enough is being done either to oversee this apparatus or to reform it.
And did the sound of that door opening and closing signal the arrival of Dana Priest?
Hi there. It is.
Good. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it was interesting. We're talking about the case of the underpants bomber, Detroit, and how it illustrated both the good and bad side of what's been going on. The way you described it in the article, the information was there, provided, but buried within a flood of information, and the people responsible for looking at it, well, nobody could figure out who was responsible for looking at it.
That's right. It's not just the flood. It's certainly that sort of deluge of information all over. But really the point here was the National Counterterrorism Center was set up specifically to be at the top of the heap, the best of the bunch. And yet when it came to flushing out every clue down to its last potential, they dropped the ball, and they did that not because, you know, they're bad people. They did it because they thought someone else was probably doing it. And so the size of the system has started to blur the responsibility within the system. And the Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, said this point to Congress when he testified. But that's sort of what's happened in other parts too. Cybersecurity is one of them, where there's just way too many people in that mix, and nobody knows exactly who's in charge, and people are taking advantage of what others are doing in order to not repeat what they have already done, but to go deeper.
There are, for obvious reasons, a lot of people you talk to who ask that their names not be used, which you accepted. But there was one general, the former head of intelligence at CENTCOM, General Custer, who told you that he went up to that National Counterterrorism Center and said, "You guys, I've been in charge of running two wars, and you've never given me one scrap of information that's helped."
He was quite passionate in his interview with me about what he thought of Washington and his huge apparatus. And, you know, he even told me that story that you just said. He needed all he could get, all the help he could get, and he found himself relying on his own people, which is fine if that's enough. But after all, there is this huge bureaucracy doing intelligence analysis in Washington. He expected it to produce something, and it was very frustrating to him that it did not.
And Bill Arkin, there was another example, and this involved the Ford Fort shooter, the alleged Ford Fort shooter, who was acting strangely at Walter Reed, where he was a psychiatrist, and there was an Army intelligence unit not far up the road that was not looking, however, at people acting strangely within the United States Army, but doing things that seven other agencies, and I'm probably being too low on that estimate, were already doing.
You know, we use the 25-mile example because the premier military intelligence organization responsible for counterintelligence is at Fort Meade, Maryland. But the reality, Neil, is that even right there at Fort Hood, at Walter Reed, his superiors, who were well aware of many of his activities and many of his thoughts, really were not themselves able to input that information into a system that was methodical. In a way, it's a really better example, I think, of how a lack of direction and a lack of true mission, a sort of a let each of the individual agencies decide for themselves what their priorities are going to be. And so here we have a case of someone who is actually in the Army, who has pretty much given up all of his rights, civil rights of scrutiny. You join the Army, and your expectation is that someone is going to be looking over your shoulder and looking at your loyalty to the country and even at more. And yet even there, the system is not focused enough. It's not directed closely enough. It doesn't have its clear priorities set in such a way that they were able to catch this person.
The job of Director of National Intelligence was, I thought, created to try to coordinate all these things, to make sure that everybody is working in concert, that they're, well, I guess, you know, some redundancies are valuable because you want to have A team and B team looking at the same data sometimes, but isn't that the DNI's job, Dana?
Well, it is the DNI's job, but the Congress didn't give him the authority to actually do that job in a way that I think most Americans think they did. He doesn't have budget power over much of the Defense Department, which has two-thirds of all the intel that goes on in its department. And more than that, though, I mean, I think the DNI has made some progress in intelligence sharing and standardizing certain practices and getting people to talk more together. But at the same time, the system just got so much bigger and seems to have overwhelmed the progress that was being made. We'll have hearings tomorrow with Jim Clapper, the new nominee for that position. Sure, this question of size and coordination has come up.
Well, until and unless he is confirmed, the acting director of National Intelligence, David Gompert, wrote in response to your piece today saying that U.S. intelligence is achieving untold successes every day. The fact that there were only a few high-profile terrorist attacks and attempts recently means they are doing a good job, that the picture you paint is not the intelligence community that we know, as you said.
Well, first of all, we asked them to share with us anything they could on plots that were foiled that we could put in the paper because we didn't have many examples. We said, give us things just in generalities, you know, they're always worried about giving away too much, and we didn't receive anything back. So if they're out there, if they happened, we could not find out about them. And what's more, he just, I'll leave it at that.
The reality is that when we saw Mr. Goffert's letter today, who said this is not the intelligence community I recognize, one of our sources quipped to us, well, isn't that the whole point of your theory? And I think that that is indeed the problem. The director of national intelligence is the director of national intelligence in name only. He doesn't really control many programs within the Pentagon or the Department of Homeland Security or in the law enforcement establishment. There is no one person in charge. And all of our sources, even on the record, Neil, in our story today, Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, agreed with our basic premise that there was no one in charge and that at the same time they were not able to really wrap their arms around the contractor problem in order to determine how many they had, let alone whether they were effective.
We're going to get the calls. We want to hear from people in the intelligence community who have the chance to see the article. Is this the intelligence community that you recognize? Give us some estimate of the growth and the effectiveness of the various agencies since 9/11. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. But before we go to calls, we've got to take a break. But I also wanted to ask you about something called SCIFs. And this is apparently the great competition within the agencies is how much SCIF space you've got.
Well, you know, personal ego comes into everything in the world, and it certainly comes into this realm as well. It's sort of a competition between who has the biggest SCIF, which is an eavesdropping-proof building. If you want to deal with classified top-secret information, you have to have one of these buildings. It makes sure that nobody from the outside can penetrate it with any kind of technical means. And I had various conversations with SCIF builders who would tell me that one agency wouldn't let the other agency see how much square footage they had in SCIF space or what kind of SCIF they had, in part because they wanted to protect it so that nobody else got as good of material as they did or what have you. And one of my favorite quotes in there is from a three-star general who has served a lot of time overseas and came to Washington for a tour and said, you know, you can't go anywhere and find a four-star general without his own security detail and entourage.
We're talking with Washington Post reporters Dana Priest and Bill Arkin about their investigative series on the massive growth and questionable efficiency of our national security and intelligence systems post 9/11. The series is called Top Secret America, three parts. It started today. Your calls after we come back from a short break. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Almost as soon as the September the 11th attacks ended, the security and intelligence apparatuses in the United States began to grow and grow. And now, according to an article that appeared in the Washington Post today, the system has become a web so unwieldy it's hard to see if it is actually making us safer. Dana Priest and William Arkin of the Washington Post are with us. They spent 2 years mapping out the sprawling geography of what they call Top Secret America. Their series appears this week in the Post. You can find a link to the first article on our website at npr.org. We want to hear from you if you've worked in the intelligence community since 9/11. Get your estimate of the growth, capability, and efficiency. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's start with John, and John's with us on the line from Berkeley.
Hi there. I had worked at a weapons lab I was working there during 9/11 and for 7 years after that. I have a DOEQ clearance, which is up to top secret. I'm a technical writer. I never edited or worked on anything top secret or confidential or even sensitive, I don't think. But the clearance cost about $3,000 and took 2 years to acquire via investigations into my past. And I know that the DOEQ clearance expires, I believe, after 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So mine, you know, would have to be reinvestigated, and only if I acquired a job that, you know, required one.
Right.
So in that sense, I think, you know, for me it was kind of a waste of money and time, although I'm happy to have it on my record because it kind of shows that I've been at least vetted thoroughly once, you know, for future jobs. But,
and
anyway.
Presumably you've done very many naughty things since then that we could,
exactly.
We could overlook.
But one other thing is I do, working at the weapons lab, I could take the whole hour talking about the inefficiency and bureaucracy there. It was just mind-numbing, you know,
and
waste.
Did that noticeably increase after 9/11?
Well, you know, I started only about 9 months before 9/11, so I really couldn't say, but according to what I learned while being there, it didn't really make, I think I was there just too short of a time to discern any before and after difference.
All right, John, thanks very much, and we hope you hope that your resume does you well.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And it's interesting, one of the things we learned in this article, I just published it already, there are many levels of clearance, not just secret, and you wrote in the piece that if you had studied all the secret programs, the people who cleared for secret, it's just too vast to even do it, but it's top secret. But there are levels above that as well, including something called SAR? SCI? Yes. Well, there was a special program.
Okay. The
SATs.
SATs.
Oh, excuse me. I got my last name. These acronyms are so hard to keep straight.
Well, you know, the further you get up, the theory is the fewer number of people see something or read into something, and so SAPs, or special access programs, as they're called, are the Defense Department's most sensitive programs. They're intelligence SAPs, they're technical SAPs, they're operational SAPs, and in the story, I talked on the record with General Clapper, who at the time was the head of the Office of Intelligence for the Secretary of Defense, and we were talking about the role, the idea of visibility. Can you see into the SAP world, and just can you see all the SAPs that there are? Because I've been told by more than a couple people that this was an issue, that it's hard to get visibility on these very special programs, and he came back and said there's only one entity in the universe that has visibility on all the SAPs, and that's God. And I said, can I put that on the record? Because we were speaking on background. And he said, oh, I don't think not nobody's going to disagree with me. So I thought that was a pretty credible quote from somebody who's been in the system a long time, understands the real problem.
You asked about that tomorrow. We'll have to see. Let's get another caller in. This is Mike. Mike on the line from Richmond.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks. Well, I not like the show so far. I just wanted to add, you know, I think the part of the issue here is that after 9/11, it's not like a whole new military-industrial complex came into existence. You know what I mean? These people who are running the intelligence community have been running it since our enemies were still very defined, not these kind of amorphous, nationless groups. You know, we have the whole full force of the technologicalized first world bearing down on, what, 800, 1,000 guys in caves? You know what I mean? We're not fighting the same kind of enemy. And I personally, you know, I used to work for an intel firm, we were part of a group consulted with Dick Clark for his book Cyber War that was just released.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my opinion, I feel that the establishment is still trying to chase the enemy the way we would chase Russians. You know what I mean?
Bill Arkin, the national security apparatus was not small, as Mike points out, before 9/11, but I think you did hundreds of agencies that were either created or reorganized afterwards.
Well, there are very many fundamental ways in which the national security apparatus of the United States has changed since 9/11. It is fundamental, Neil. First and foremost is the growth of ad hoc organizations. A whole new set of organizations superimposed upon existing agencies, and many of those new organizations are compartmented or work on their own or are not tied into the overall system, and that's one of the problems that we discovered. The second is the enormous use of contractors and in national security matters today, and this is not a question of contractors not existing before 9/11, But before 9/11, the contractor's main job in the national security establishment was to build equipment and maintain that technical equipment. And today, most of those contractors are engaged in the provision of services. That is, they produce paper. They're involved in policy making. They're involved in war planning. They're involved in sitting in intelligence watch centers, et cetera. They are a literal augmentation of the U.S. government, and those are people who are not public servants. They're people who are working for profit companies. The third major change is the concentration of activity in Washington, D.C., which we concentrate in on the second story and the third stories, which will come out tomorrow and Wednesday. And here, it really is phenomenal. Washington has seen an explosion of buildings, an explosion of new agencies, an influx of people. Corporations have moved to Washington to be part of this system, and we really have fundamentally altered the landscape of the United States by virtue of putting so much emphasis and so much power behind the national security establishment that is located in the Washington area.
Mike, thanks very much. Here's an email from, this is Gabriel in Kansas City. I've heard most of these different departments are privatized. I think he's talking about contractors, which Bill Arkin just talked about. Is that true? And if so, you can talk a little more about that. I know tomorrow's article focuses on that, but Dana Priest, today's article pointed out, not just doing the tasks that Bill Arkin was just talking about, but all the air conditioner repairmen, the landscapers, indeed the janitors need top secret clearance.
Exactly. Once you start that ball rolling, you get a whole lot of other people come on board, because once you make a site secure like that, anybody that goes in and out of it, anybody who cleans it, anybody who builds it, even there are architects and top secret clearances, it just becomes a network, if you will, of support. And in fact, many companies that contract with the government see this sort of support for the government, providing with janitors and all sorts of gardeners, as you said.
Let's go next to John, and John's on the line with us from Miami.
Hey, John,
your cell phone is betraying you. I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go, and I hope you call back. It looks like you had an interesting question. In the meantime, let's see if we can go. This is Andy with us from Toledo.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm former intelligence, what they call special intelligence business, worked with NSA, CIA, and DOD. And what struck me about the community was the incredible politicization and turf building and turf control efforts, and I'm sure that hasn't changed. And back in 1947, there was OSS and Army, all these various intelligence agencies whose efforts needed to be coordinated. Coordination was vested in a new agency called the Central Intelligence Agency, and that was led by the Director of Central Intelligence, whose job it was to coordinate all the intelligence work. Now, instead of dealing with the very turf-sensitive environment there, we've installed a Director of National Intelligence to coordinate the work of the Director of Central Intelligence and the other agencies. I'm frankly pessimistic. Over.
Well, the idea was, I think, as I recall the argument, Dana Priest, that the Director of Central Intelligence had enough to do directing the Central Intelligence Agency, and that given all this growth, that we needed somebody else in a new agency to overlook all these different agencies and do the work previously done by the Director of Central Intelligence. But turf wars and hiding intelligence from somebody else was again not exactly unknown before the creation of the DNI.
No, it wasn't. But I think we've shown that it's not gotten a whole lot better. I would say that information sharing has gotten better. That people come together more and produce reports and send them to other agencies and that sort of thing. That definitely has improved, but the turf battles for money in particular, I think, are very tense. People tend, maybe this is just the nature of bureaucracies, and never to want to cut down and be smaller, always to want to grow. And then when you put in there the profit motive of corporations, not to criticize that, that's, you know, the American way, but when it's in a closed system that no one can see, that people can't judge and say, well, hey, know, gave that contract away for so much more money, the sole source contract, it just makes it makes it harder to make sure the system's doing the right thing, and companies have a motive also to grow, not to shrink. And so you've got these two dynamics moving the system into being bigger. Nobody in Congress will say enough. It's not politically correct to say, are you sure we need to spend that much? In fact, that's always the solution for a problem, is to throw more money at it.
Yeah, Bill Arkin, you described that again, going back to the case of the underpants farmer in Detroit, the solution proposed was, well, we need more analysts. We need to add more to the hundreds, the thousands that we've already got.
Indeed, I think, Neil, that we've seen in all the evidence that we've collected and all of the interviews that we've done and in the extensive material which we've put online at topsecretamerica.com, that this is a system of tremendous duplication, and it is so much so that for the intelligence community or for U.S. government officials to argue at this point that these are necessary redundancies is really ridiculous. I mean, we have found just pockets of the same exact work being done in a wide variety of agencies. And why is that work done? Because that's what's hot. And when something gets hot, when it's of national importance, when it gets the interest of Congress, then the money flows. And so if counter IEDs, countering improvised explosive devices in Afghanistan and Iraq, becomes the hot issue, I'm not saying that we shouldn't solve the problem, but what the reality is that the bureaucracy and the private sector respond with a vengeance, building their own intelligence, building their own capabilities, building their own investigators, building their own networks, building their own organizations, because that's where the money is going, and the day-to-day intelligence suffers as these new ad hoc organizations are created. And we saw examples of that again and again and again, where people would say to us, well, such and such is hot, and so therefore we have to now take what we're doing and rename it something else in order to get enough money to do what we want to do.
William Arkin, National Security Reporter for The Washington Post.
Well, that segment goes on about four more minutes, but one of the things that comes up in this is they actually have people that head up some of these intelligence agents. We're talking about the 1,200 different organizations that have subunits under their authority that when they ask about them, they're told that they're not allowed to know anything about them because it's top secret and they don't have access. But this is one of the ways of hiding some of these competitive type of private security organizations and other organizations. In other words, it's turf battles, continuous turf battles. But think of this, 1,200 public organizations, 1,900 private contract organizations, 1,900, we're not talking about locations, different companies, and 10,000 locations in the United States, and we couldn't find the Fordo shooter when there was information stacked about this guy. So something has to be stopped, and let's just add, can you even put a price tag on this? It's probably not even possible. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed what you heard tonight. Please go to Top Secret America. They are only getting started, and you can read the article. I printed it out. It's about 31 pages for the three segments, and there's some other audio and video on there that I think that you would, in fact, enjoy. So hope you enjoyed the show tonight. We're going to be signing off, and we'll have Vera Lynn take us on out, and we'll see you again.
We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We meet again.